So, Peter, since you've become head teacher, there's been this great doubling. There's been a doubling of pupils, a doubling of your budget, and not quite, but almost a doubling of your staff. So that's since 2020. What has been going on in your school since then? Why do you think that doubling's taken place?
That's a good question, Matt. I think there's a whole lot of things. I think one, the school, when I came in, I knew had a huge amount of potential in so many different facets, not just in education, but within the community. And there had been very little marketing or promotion or links with the Department of Education even, and other schools done prior to me being there. So to be able to, we brought in a development manager pretty quickly after I was there, and to get some permanent signage on the dual carriageway between Bangor and Hollywood. I then sat on the Review of Education panel, which brought my form of education or our form of education to the Department of Education much more directly, and just making ourselves more public, more accessible.
Because you were a real hidden gem.
The school called themselves a hidden treasure at the top of Croft Road in Hollywood. And I live in Crawfordsburn and I didn't even know where the school was until about 5 years ago, because it's not on a main thoroughfare and there was no permanent signage in place. But I think, you know, ultimately when I found out about the school and I spent a little bit of time in there and realised how wonderful the culture was and what a wonderful provision the children get, I thought, okay, I'm a parent. What do I ultimately want here? And what I ultimately want is that every parent in Northern Ireland who has young children knows that we exist. They don't have to choose us, but they need to know, or they should have the right to know, that there's something that's slightly different that has massive benefits that they should maybe come and investigate for their own children. And if they don't like it, that's completely fine. But I think parents have the right to be informed of what's out there.
Sure. And I was talking to you off mic there, like, recent dad, I've got a 3-year-old and a 6-month-old. And, you know, I've been in Northern Ireland most of my life, went through the education system. And I only found out like 3 months ago that there was such a thing as alternative education in Northern Ireland. I just thought there was the one type of white bread and that's all there was. And all of a sudden it's like, I didn't even know you could homeschool in Northern Ireland. Never mind, you know, schools like yours. Why do you think people don't know about it?
Well, it's really interesting because we have different families at our school, and an awful lot of the families, one parent is from Northern Ireland and the other parent is from overseas. So starting school at 4 years of age, sitting at a desk in a classroom with 29 other children is quite alien to a lot of people from Europe, Australasia and North America. So they challenge the system that their child is now in because they think it's a bit irregular, because most children around the world start formal education at 6 years of age. And I think then the other side of that is, if both parents are from Northern Ireland, you know, we're probably all ingrained in that 11 plus, which became AQEGL, which is now SEAG. That's the system that we want our children to get the best out of. And I think unless you're really involved in education, you probably don't look deeply enough about possibly trying to break or change that system. You just want to get the best out of it.
Right.
And ultimately that is, if you decide your child's going to do this test, you prepare them probably with a tutor outside of their primary school education, and you want the best school for them. What is the best school? That depends on individual interests. And I think we're caught up in that cycle. And because there really only are two fully functioning independent schools, so Rockport, just down at Seahill across the road from us, and ourselves in Hollywood, there's not a plethora of private education available in Northern Ireland. And even, you know, there's been prep schools attached to post-primary schools, but an awful lot of those have closed over the last 5 to 10 years. And that trend seems to be continuing.
Mm. So tell us a little bit about your school and why it's different than, say, the school I would have went to.
Where did you go, Matt?
Well, I first went to Ballymacash. I was born and bred in Lisburn, which is a big reveal that the guy behind Best of Belfast isn't actually from Belfast. Should be Best of Ballymacash. So I did my primary there. I ended up in McGabbery Primary for my later, and then I went to Wallace for my secondary.
Very good. Well, the reason I asked that is good to know, because I had 15 years in the grammar sector, so it's kind of good to know what your experience was like, sort of a fair idea what you got out of Wallace, which is an excellent school. So really, our school, it's not really that different, but yet to the naked eye, it probably looks very different. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's a school. We have school buildings. We have a curriculum. Our times are pretty much the same. Our holidays are the same. Our teachers are all qualified in the same way as they would be at Wallace or McGabbery. But I suppose the most visible differences to parents going on the website or coming to visit is that the children don't wear school uniform. So they have their own identity. The hope is that they feel very comfortable in their own skin and they don't have to conform, particularly to a shirt and a tie from, you know, 4 years of age up to 11 years of age, which some primary schools still do, which when you think about it, you know, you have a beautiful workspace here. I bet you there's nobody here wearing a tie.
Do you know what? You beat me to it. I literally was going to say, isn't it funny that we train our kids still under the shirt and tie sort of office factory model?
Yeah.
But if you look around, at not everyone, but a lot of people who are very successful, who've forged a different path,
yep,
they're not wearing a tie.
No. And the only people probably, if you walk through Belfast now, will be school children and possibly people in the legal system and yeah, not too many others, you know. Yeah, so there's no school uniform, which is one thing. And then the second thing, which is probably the biggest factor, is you can start preschool in our school, which is 3 to 4 years of age. And then we run a kindergarten, which is kindergarten one and kindergarten two, which is the equivalent of P1 and P2, where they don't sit in a classroom at a desk. Mm. So it's all play-based and outdoor learning. So the children don't sit in a classroom in an educational environment, as you or I would have known when we were at school, until they're 6 turning 7, so P3. And that's when they begin to read, and that's when they pick up a second language also. And what you then find is that all of the children in the year that they're 6 turning 7, so class 1 or P3, they all pick up reading very, very quickly without too many hurdles or barriers or problems. And I think one of the big problems that I have seen is that children who are 4, some can begin reading and pick it up wonderfully, but an awful lot can't. And they have a sort of a disassociation with reading because they're not developed enough to actually grasp a lot of the concepts. So they fall out of love with it. They feel they're not very good at it compared to their peers because they're maybe in the 4th or the 5th reading group out of 5.
Right.
So to cry and just say to parents, you know, most countries around the world wait until we're 6. Just relax. They will do all the precursors to numeracy and literacy. They will learn how to cook 3-course meals. They will learn how to knit, weave. They'll learn how to use tools. They will learn a whole lot of skills to make them more resilient, as opposed to putting them into this educational environment at 4 years of age.
Mm. If I pay you, can you teach Daniel how to cook a 3-course meal?
I'm sure Daniel would be more than capable.
I'm actually just kind of learning to cook a little bit. So that's kind of where this is coming from, because Matthew's been teaching me over some time about how to cook some meals. So, yeah.
Now he's probably just giving you the recipes that he likes.
Actually, no, it's been, he's been asking me what I wanted to cook and all that. So I've just been doing basic things like, oh, I want to learn how to cook chicken.
Yeah, we're on chicken wings at the minute. Okay.
Chicken wings at the minute, chicken wing grind. Yeah.
Very good. And then I suppose the other difference is teachers, staff go by their first name. Mm-hmm. So again, having 15 years in the grammar sector where it was Sir or Mr. Chambers, you know, it's now Peter, which took a few days for me to get used to, but it's wonderful. It's the tone that pupils use regardless of what they call you, and it's the manner and the respect that they show when they say that. So those are the three big visible differences. You're not sitting at a desk till you're 6. There's no school uniform and teachers go by their first name.
Mm-hmm. I think you accidentally, or maybe not accidentally, I'm probably susceptible to be your target market right now because, like I said, my wife's German and our family, so my 3-year-old, her cousins are just 1 year ahead. And so they've started kindergarten and they're all in forests and jumping out of trees and not at a desk. And whenever we kind of are explaining to the family, it's like, yeah, you know, our daughter, she's going to be starting preschool and nursery soon. And this is what they do. They're aghast. They're like, what? You would do that to your child? You would make them sit like that? Like, that's not what kids do. And as you say, it's interesting. And I love talking to people on this show where it forces you to maybe think, oh, maybe the way that we do things isn't the only way to do things. Why do you think it's important to delay that desk type work, other than what you already said about reading? Because I take your point fully. We do expect our kids to almost run before they're even crawling when it comes to reading. But are there any other benefits for delaying that a little bit?
Well, look at all the models of child development and child psychology. And it all points in that direction. So I think we're just caught up in a system because I think, you know, if you ask any primary school principal, a lot of what they're held accountable for are the CAG or what was AQE and GL, previously 11 plus, those results and the preparation that goes on to get children to certain levels, even from key stage one, from P2, P3, upwards, which has an impact on the amount of homework and the amount of testing children are exposed to. That's a very unfortunate system, and to be removed from that and not feel that, so like nobody in our school gets homework until they're P6, okay, because they're in school for 6.5-7 hours a day. That's a long period of time of focus, so there shouldn't be any need. Now, homework does come in at a later stage to create habits for independent learning. But I think really what you're trying to do between 4 and 6 years of age is you're trying to develop self-regulation, and you're trying to give children opportunities to become really resilient. And what I mean by that is they're not afraid to make mistakes, and they accept making mistakes is a really common part of life. It can happen and probably should happen daily, but it's completely fine. So what you find is in our kindergarten play area, it's particularly risque and challenging, and the children are encouraged to challenge themselves physically, and they do get the odd bump or bruise. Now, we do, we've risk assessments and health and safety policies and so forth. But really what you want then is, and you see the children who've been through kindergarten, who then come and sit in a class when they're six, these are the children who will constantly want to answer questions, will constantly want to write things down, will constantly make mistakes, but are okay with that.
Wow.
And you compare that to the children that then maybe join us because of their primary school journey maybe hasn't been what they hoped, who are maybe compressed and just don't want to make a mistake. So they're not letting themselves go. They're not really curious. They don't have a sense of wonder for the world. And that, you can see a marked difference in the children who've been through the play-based 4 to 6 year of age model in kindergarten and the ones who've been through the mainstream model, where maybe they've been exposed to assessments and groups where they're not at the top, so they feel not particularly good about themselves. So I think that's the biggest difference. And I think ultimately, you know, we all walked and talked at different stages, but we're not held accountable for that, or we're not, you know, you walked at 9 months, I walked at 8 months. I'm in a better walking group than you. But yet we do that with children from such a young age, but yet everybody develops at different stages. And to allow the time and the freedom and not have an academic test at 11 years of age, it just opens up the curriculum to try and meet what is right for individuals, as opposed to get them to fit into a system that we're trying to get them to pass to get to the next stage of their education.
Like, I'm so compelled by the holistic model of, like, I know we joked about it earlier with Daniel, but like teaching kids how to cook, you know, a second language, like how that sets you up for your life. You know, what learning a second language does to your brain, like the wiring of your brain is crazy. And then the practical skills, and you know, every old man from Belfast has been saying this for years, but it's like, you know, how great would it be if schools taught kids how to live a little bit more, you know, how to cook, how to maybe fix something, how to do their taxes, you know what I mean? Like things like that. And so I love that you guys are taking a whole education approach there. It's powerful.
Well, do you know, the curriculum is 100 years old. Now, it's obviously evolved and it is progressive. But so woodwork, the children start woodwork very early on in their lower school or primary school journey. So they will be using all natural materials, and they'll learn how to whittle, how to carve. They'll be able to carve boats, three-legged stools, four-legged chairs, all these wonderful things. So they're very, very handy. And those are skills that I still don't really have. My wife would certainly say I don't have. That I would have loved the opportunity at school to be able to do all of those, particularly at such an impressionable age where children absorb so much learning and so much information. And that, I think, you know, we have a maximum of 10 children in the woodwork room at any one time. And we have a phenomenal woodwork teacher who's also a blacksmith, a stone carver, basket weaver, does all these wonderful activities with the children. And it just prepares them for life outside of school. And also, in a world where we're all swiping left, swiping right, looking for quick fixes, woodwork is a subject where you need to put a bit of time and effort and overcome some barriers, because it can be difficult, but you will produce something that will last for a lifetime. And that's a really important message in a world that we live in today, that with a little bit of hard work, dedication, some assistance and support from your teacher, that you can make something that will be there forever.
And what I like about that is it's a physical embodiment of the work you've done. A less weird way to say that is you can actually see your work, and you can look back on that over the weeks and months and maybe even years where you're like, hey, look, I remember that. Yeah. I remember that was really hard. I remember that wee corner there was really, really difficult, and, you know, miss whatever, well, you don't say miss. My teacher helped me with this part. My friend helped me with that bit. And you're right. You know, so much of what we do is not physical, not tangible. Yeah. And the fact that you do that's really cool. What's your either in school or out of school. What's your kind of thoughts on screens and screen time? And, you know, how do you balance raising kids that are digital natives, as they will have to be, with giving them space to also be kids and not get plugged into the matrix straight away?
Well, do you know, it's a very interesting question. So we're under an umbrella body called Waldorf UK. So Waldorf is the name of the curriculum and Steiner is the name of the school. But the curriculum is the absolute wonderful product that the school had, not just our school, but the 2,000 schools around the world. So, you know, we kind of follow instruction and progression through Waldorf UK, and we don't really have any exposure to IT until the children are about 11, 12 years of age. And the reason for that is, well, there's a couple of reasons. One, it's a bit of a digital detox because we know children are getting lots of exposure to iPads and whatever else at home, of course they are. Is there any real need for them to be IT literate at 6, 7, 8 years of age? That can come at a later stage. And also, and a big thing that I have noticed from my mainstream experience to where I am now is that in the lower school, so the primary school, different than the upper school where we do have IT, obviously, but in the lower school, the teachers don't have a laptop or a computer on their desk. So they're present, physically present with the children for every minute that they're with them. And then admin and things that they're expected to do, they wouldn't do that in the classroom in front of the children. So you're getting a present role model there all of the time. And yeah, we obviously do use IT as the children get older, but that's why a lot of parents want to come to the school, because they don't want, you know, a huge amount of IT because their child maybe gets a fair amount at home. Now, it does come with complexities because there are so many wonderful learning tools that you can use on iPads and interactive whiteboards that we don't currently use in the lower school. But do you know what, Matt? There's a real beauty, and there's a real kind of old school feel about walking into a Waldorf classroom. And ultimately, what it allows, and this is pretty powerful stuff, it allows children to stay as children for longer. So in a world where you have 13, 14-year-olds, even younger than that, children exposed to things that we would never have been exposed to because we wouldn't have had the access to it.
Yeah.
And they're not developmentally ready to deal with that or to even gauge how they feel on that. So you tend to find if you walked into a classroom in my school of, let's say, year 8 first form, which we call class 6, to me, they would look about 10 or 11 years of age, maybe even a little bit younger, you know. And there's something wholesome and wonderful about that.
Well, I think that's the way it should be. I think kids should be kids.
Yeah, I'd also like to jump in here as well, because something you said earlier on about even teaching kids a different language as well, like a second language, that's something that really spoke to me in a case, because that's something I wish I had whenever I was little, because I think it's easier to learn a second language whenever your parents like encourage it and talk to you in a different language in front of that, and hearing about like you wanting to incorporate that into kindergarten and all that, the first P1 and P2 years, it really does say something, because I didn't learn Spanish until I was in year 10. So how would you go about teaching that?
Great question.
Couple kids.
Yeah, so we don't start in kindergarten. German starts in class 1, which is P3, so 6 years of age. And the reason it's German was that Waldorf schools were founded in Germany, and it's a huge part of the curriculum. So we have a German department. So like any prep school, we have upper school teachers who specialise in subjects who then come down and take the younger children. So the German teachers will come down into class 1, class 2, and they'll have at least one lesson a week where they begin German. But, you know, you ask the question, how do you do that? It's the perfect age to begin a second language. You know, these children are beginning to obviously flourish with reading. They really get involved in their numeracy. Their brains are really open to receive information, to absorb it, and also to probe and be curious and ask questions. So it's the perfect time to start that. What I've always been real, and we have a lot of families like this in our school, and I've always been very envious of the families where the child or the children have one parent who speaks English as their first language and the other parent speaks another language as their first language. And these children are obviously fluent in both and have been from a very young age. And I've always been envious of families like that. Because both my parents are wonderful and lovely people and I love them very much, but they're both from Northern Ireland.
I mean, it's crazy because, I mean, we're in a fortunate position, my wife being German, she only speaks German to the kids. Like, our three-year-old's fluent. Mm-hmm. Like, my three-year-old is translating stuff for me. Like, wrap your head around that.
That's brilliant, isn't it? And what an advantage.
Oh, it's just insane. And it comes so, so naturally to them. Mm-hmm. But it's such a gift because it just sets them up.
And how's your German?
My German's pretty good, so I would be conversational. And I've got to the point where, you know, your level of education typically only rise to the necessity. No one can gossip about me or no one can slabber about me.
Okay.
And that...
So you don't feel left out of conversations?
No. I can follow along with everything. Once we start getting into more complex types of discussions, it would be very hard for me to articulate. But I could understand what's going on, if that makes sense.
That's good. Yeah.
But it is, it's a magic thing. And the fact that it just comes so naturally to them is crazy.
Well, the other wonderful thing that happens in our school is, so funny, you mentioned your wife being German. So there's a huge Waldorf school in Bochum in Germany. So when our children get into class 9, which is year 11 or fourth form for your older listeners, our children have the opportunity to go to Bochum to a German school for 3 to 6 weeks. So most of them will go and do an exchange. Now, obviously the German children all speak English, but they get hosted by a family. And they immerse themselves in the Waldorf curriculum in that school for 3 to 6 weeks. And then, so our children did that in November, just in the lead up to Christmas. And then the German children will come to us in February, just after February half term, and be hosted by the families then. So we will have a whole bunch of German students with us, which again is wonderful for the environment and the educational landscape of the school.
Yeah, because to your point, Daniel, like whenever you start learning, let's say French, as I think we did in when we were 11 or 12, you know, you've no interest in it. You're not great at it. The way it's taught doesn't really work. And then everyone just speaks Northern Irish French. Do you know what I mean? It's like, comment s'appelle tu, je m'appelle Matthew. And you never quite get it. Whereas the kids that I've seen who start really early, they get it. And this is probably something to do with your how, you know, elastic your brain is or whatever. I'm sure you would.
Well, you hit the nail on the head there. You started French at probably 11 or 12 years of age, as did I. But you've got a preconception that you probably don't really want to do it.
Yeah.
Because of the age that you are, the education that you've had until that point, and maybe the way it's delivered or sold and where it is on your timetable within school. Children don't think like that when they're 6 or 7 years of age. Children generally love life and really just see what's right in front of them. So
time, come on!
So it's a wonderful opportunity. And I think the longer you leave that, it's a bit like, you know, music, like piano lessons or singing lessons. You know, the later you start, then I suppose the more barriers and the more compression and the more fear and anxiety there is in there, as opposed to starting when children are much younger.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, the way my brain internalized it was, you try to create an environment where failure is not only accepted, but celebrated. We do a lot of work on the other side where people are in their 20s and their 30s in an environment like this, in a very entrepreneurial world where people are trying to take risks and they're trying to start something new. And it's so embedded in the Northern Irish psyche. Don't take a risk. Don't take, you know, failure is bad. Stay away from making mistakes. If you make a mistake, try to hide it. Don't own up to it. It's very shameful. There's a lot of guilt. How do you try to counteract that in the classroom from that young age?
Would you? I think a lot of what you've said, I would agree with. And I think if you speak to, and I'm sure you have through your podcast, you speak to a lot of sports stars from Northern Ireland, even perhaps people who maybe haven't quite made it to the top level. They would, a lot of those people would probably say the same thing, that perhaps there was a bit of a self-depreciation against themselves and a lack of belief that actually that they were maybe good enough. And I think it all comes down to school culture. So, do you know, really in our schools, and the culture before I came in was wonderful, and I hope that has continued. I think it has, and hopefully I've been able to add a little bit to that. But what I mean by that is that a Waldorf school is all about relationships, like every school should be. So really, you know, is every child comfortable? If not, why not? If they're not comfortable in the classroom, on the basketball court, in the music room, in the science lab, in the woodwork room, it is our job to make every child comfortable. And if we can't do that, then we probably have failed with that child. If they're comfortable, and that has to be revisited all the time, then are they given daily opportunities to be confident and to be successful? And that could be numeracy, literacy, science, it could be social and emotional, it could be behavioural. It could be some kinesthetic or hearing aid that perhaps is needed because of noise issues. So again, it needs to be tailored to every child. So what you're trying to do is create an environment where children are comfortable and every day are gaining confidence. Mm. And that's a big ask, and that's a big task for teachers to do. And the academic material is put on top of that. So the foundation is those relationships, and academia is put on top of that. Whereas what you'll find in most mainstream schools, it's kind of the other way around. Not necessarily through the fault of the school, but through the way ETI works and how schools are so accountable.
And ETI, sorry, is?
The Education and Training Inspectorate.
Gotcha.
So primary schools are held so accountable for academic selection at 11 and obviously post-primaries for GCSEs and A-levels. And I think, you know, to kind of understand and realise, and particularly as an independent school where you have autonomy over your finances and you can spend your money in the way that you think is right for the children, to realise that actually academic outcomes will come. It's a bit like winning a football match. You're not going to focus at the top level on the result. You're going to focus on the minute detail to get a good performance in different aspects of the game, and that should produce that result that you desire. So like our GCSE results, we're not a selective school. We're not a grammar school like Wallace, but 88% of our students last year get 7A star to C, including English and maths. That's incredible.
That's insane.
It's insane, yeah. And, you know, we've no academic selection. We don't do any formal academic testing until the children are 13 years of age. Now, the teachers know where the children are,
of course,
but they're not exposed to a test. So there's a whole body of research to be done on this compared to where we currently are with testing from a very, very young age. You know, and then so in this last exam cycle there at GCSEs, 35% of our grades were A star or A. Right, those results are phenomenal, and it has to come down to a couple of things. One, less children in the room. So we have a maximum class size of 20.
Interesting.
Yep. So we'll not compromise on that because then you're diluting the mm-hmm. product a little bit. So the children get much more individual attention than perhaps they would in a bigger school. They also have probably, I would imagine, stronger relations with their teachers because they see more of them and there are less of them.
And as you say, they're present. They're not on their laptop. They're not banging out their admin stuff during class.
So I think there's that. And then I think there's also the element of the vast majority of children who have come through the system, they haven't been exposed to testing right the way through. So, for example, if you're in first form, year eight, and you're sitting all your different Christmas exams and you've done particularly maybe poorly compared to your peers in three or four subjects, you have this self-fulfilling prophecy that you're not good at something. Because at that particular time, based on that bit of work, you're maybe not.
Bro, I got 36% in physics one year, I remember.
But what's to say in two or three years' time, as you maybe develop a little bit later than others, that you might actually flourish, but your card's marked.
Yeah.
And in your head, you've already given up. There's a barrier mm-hmm. there.
And I got funneled down hardcore in the arts and humanities.
Okay.
Because I think early on, I didn't grasp the science stuff. Whereas see now, I'm actually really, really interested in all that sort of stuff. So it is interesting how you can kind of get pigeonholed into categories and boxes and where that kind of leads you to.
And I think what's interesting, you know, you look at the Craigavon area, which has a thing called the Dixon Plan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where there's a selection takes place at 14 years of age.
We just had Kyle McCallan on the show. He's the principal of Lurgan College.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked a lot about that. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I know Kyle well, and he's done a great job. He had a very quick journey through Lurgan from PE right up to his headship. But that model of you know, 14 years of age, you've given the children an additional 3 years. They have more of an idea. You have more of an idea. And I'm surprised that model hasn't gone any further than that sort of Craigavon area and that small bunch of schools. But I think primary schools in Northern Ireland are wonderful places. And I think if there wasn't the current academic selection at 11 years of age, it would open up primary schools to have forest schools, to have gardening, to have ecology clubs, to have cookery schools, all these wonderful activities that children love and all the skills that they get from them, not just practicals. Confidence, resilience, self-awareness, self-assurance,
mm-hmm.
And not be, you know, exposed to so many assessments before they reach 11 years of age.
Yeah, that confidence thing is huge, isn't it?
Another thing as well that you were saying about the smaller classes, I can not further agree with it as much as I can because of the fact that I'm fresh out of school. I've just done my A-levels, and I think the best learning experience I had was from A-levels because of how small the classes were. There's probably like six of us in a class and all, but I had the best learning experience then because not only could I build a better connection with the teacher, but it was more of a free zone in the end. It was, it wasn't, you know, getting easily distracted by everyone else around you because of how small the classes were and the fact that we all wanted to learn. I don't know. It just helps. Smaller class, it just really does help.
Yeah.
I think you've mentioned a couple of really things there. You're right. You get to know the teacher much better, but also less distractions. And you know, if you can create a culture in a school where not all, but the majority of children want to learn because A, they're having fun, they've got a smile on their face, and the standard of teaching and learning is of the highest order. If you remove those distractions, then you tend to have a much, much better experience. And I think the other thing for you then, you're talking about A-levels, you've chosen to come back to school. So the people who choose to come back, you hope, are coming back for reasons such as you did.
You mentioned earlier being a private school, you can do things a little bit differently. You mentioned you can spend money the way you see fit. What are some of the, if you compare it to say like a traditional school model, what are some of the weirdest and wonderful things that you've spent money on recently?
Well, unfortunately, with the storms and the cold and wet weather, roofs, tiles and repairs, unfortunately. We've different budgets, obviously, for various different things. And every year we'll sit down as a senior leadership team and we'll look at, okay, what is it that we want to... So in our school development plan, the first year of our three-year plan is we look at, are we an inviting school? So is every aspect of our school inviting? The second year, which is this current year, are we authentic? So do we do what we say we do? And how do we evidence that? And how do we showcase that? And then next year is how progressive a school are we? So what is it that we want to bring in to make us more progressive and to improve? And an awful lot of that progression is based on finances. Mm-hmm. So for example, we're hoping to bring in iPads for the older children from September time 2024. So that will come at a significant cost. So it's important that we budget for that. There are other things like, for example, we have a preschool and we have a kindergarten, but I would love to consider our preschool relocating in. We have a full forest on campus, relocating into the forest in some form of wooden structure, which would be much more outdoor based, which would then open up our preschool to be an even bigger kindergarten. So there are plans like that. I would also love to take away the back of one of our main buildings and build two really open, big, new classrooms. So we have three schools on site. We have early years, preschool and kindergarten, which is a really, really good building and phenomenal outdoor play space. Then we have the lower school, which is a purposely built school building that was built in the late 80s with lottery funding, which is pretty good, lovely science labs, music rooms. But then we have on the site the original house, which was built in the early 1900s, which is a beautiful private residence, but has been changed into a school, which comes with its complexities. So it would be lovely to spend some money on making that a little bit more progressive and nicer for the children and to attract more families, obviously, also.
Absolutely. So you have used quite a few sports examples and metaphors throughout the conversation. You have a strong background in the athletic world.
Well, I was a PE teacher. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. And funnily enough, I travelled around the world playing rugby for many years and never ever considered becoming a teacher. But I loved coaching rugby. And I realised as I got older and playing was becoming more difficult or more painful, I thought, you know, I really enjoy making people better at stuff. So then I thought, well, we'll try the teaching gig, you know, mainly to coach rugby, not to teach really, you know, it was an avenue in. And then obviously other things take over and you get leadership opportunities and it all kind of went from there. And then I think as I really enjoyed making an impact on making pupils better, whether it be on the rugby field or in the classroom, I then realised what an influence you can have on adults. Mm. And as a principal, I ultimately see my job as making sure that the adults are the best version of themselves because they're the people who have the impact on the children, not necessarily me. So my job in leadership is really to provide care and support and challenge to the adults in my care to make them progressive, make them authentic, make them inviting, to ensure that our children are getting the best version of each adult that stands in front of them. And a lot of that ties back to sport.
Yeah.
Because basically you're trying to achieve the same thing. You're trying to see improvement. Yeah. And performance.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't want to bash traditional education. I don't want to, you know, hop on a soapbox because we're all in a different environment. But I have lots of friends, as I said to you before, who work in teaching. And I see that they are limited to becoming the best version of themselves due to constraints of the system. So, you know, they've got 29 kids in their class. Maybe they're not getting support with differently abled kids in the classroom. There's a lot of stress there. There's a lot of different things that they're having to do. And that is bound to have an effect on the overall results of the kids. So I'm very attracted to your model and the way you guys are doing things, because I think it also is a better environment for teachers. Because everyone who gets into teaching that I know, they want to change kids' lives. It's like nursing. My wife comes from a nursing background. Same heart, but you get in and the system is so burdensome, mm-hmm. I'll say, that it can be very hard for you to actually authentically do the work in the way that you would like to. I'll put it like that.
Well, I think you're very true. And having been a teacher, and I had a wonderful mainstream experience, no regrets whatsoever. But you feel every day, because you can't meet every child's needs. Of course you can't. You say you have 20 or 30 children in front of you, you can't meet every child's needs. That's impossible. So your expectations tend to drop, you know, and sometimes you work towards the lowest common denominator. And you know, our school by no means is perfect, but I think having less children in the room is such a big factor on being able to meet children's needs. And so I liken it a wee bit to, like, you know, having a personal trainer compared to going to a spin class of 30 people where you're all asked, another sporting metaphor, you're all asked to turn your resistance up by 2 at the same time. Do you know, whereas that would not be the case. You know, children, obviously they're scaffolding, there's different targets in place for individual children, there's different amounts of homework, and that all comes with a fair bit of work. But ultimately what you want is you want the children to be engaged, you want them to be enthused, and you want them to love coming to school. Mm. And if you lose that, very hard to get that back again. So it's trying to continually fuel that sort of engagement and that love of being in school and wanting to learn new things and be curious. Like, in a world that we live in today, you want curiosity. Yeah. You want children to have a sense of wonder for the world that they live in and ask questions and probe and become really involved in the things that matter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As well as that, so with this kind of case, of course, with the smaller classes and the fact that you want school to be fun, the teacher needs to also, like, have a good relationship with the student, but also keep things professional. So my question is, how exactly would teachers kind of go about keeping it professional, but also making it a fun area for kids?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people hearing that they've dropped the Mr. and the Mrs.
Mm.
You know, that might be strange for a Northern Irish brain to process.
Well, yeah, and I was that person when I came in from the mainstream system. I thought, right, well, we'll see how this plays out. But ultimately, it comes back to culture. You know, it comes back to, and what I mean by culture is it's how people treat each other. So it's how adults treat each other as role models, first and foremost. So you'll never hear an adult shout in our school, and you hopefully will never see an adult walk quickly. So we are always trying to embody calmness at all times. And you tend to find that's reflected in the majority of children. So you're consistent in your calm behaviour, even though your head might be going 100 miles an hour. You know, you try not to show that. And I think then what you tend to find, so we have positive conduct policies, we have anti-bullying policies, like every other school, of course we do. But there are very, very few behavioural issues. And again, it has to come back to culture.
Mm.
So the teachers show the children a relatively large amount of respect. And what you tend to find is that is reciprocal from the children. It's like, you'll rarely hear a child swear. And we've children right up to 17 years of age. You'll rarely hear bad language. Nobody drops a litter. I call it a bubble of comfort.
Mm.
I'm not sure our school is totally reflective of the outside world, but it's a really lovely, safe place where people are kind, people are empathetic and tolerant of one another. And we have a whole, you know, we have people from all over the world, every corner of the earth in our school, which again, I think is part of why the culture is maybe so empathetic and so understanding of so many different people. So to answer your question, you know, in my old grammar school, you know, I had a heavy role in pastoral care and most of that time was taken up with issues. Very little of my time or the pastoral team in my school's time is taken up with concerns or issues. And I don't exactly know why, because I don't feel the need. It's a bit like we have really no issues with mobile phones. So why would I go and investigate why when we have a policy like every other school. But there's lots of little things that happen in the school that I think mainstream schools are trying to get to that already existed before I was there. And these things are really wonderful. And the fact that, you know, we've four teachers in school at the minute who came from mainstream and moved to us for their own reasons. And if you ask any of the four of them, they will say they can just teach. You know, they can come in and they can just freely teach. There's not issues with classroom management or disruption. The children want to be there. They seem engaged. They're open to help. And they feel a bit like what you were saying, Matt. They now feel that they're making a difference. Mm. Whereas in their previous posts, they were maybe fighting fire every day and surviving. You know, and I think, again, that, again, has to come to, like, we've only 170 kids. You know, there's schools like you went to will have, you know, close to over 1,000 children. But what government is going to fund a model of 15 or 20 children to a teacher? Probably none. So that is the beauty of what you get, I suppose, if you can pay for a private education.
Yeah. Peter, I am more than sold.
I might have to have a conversation with you whenever we go off here, but... for, you know, the parent listening to this who they feel that stirring in their heart, you know, it's they're really, really resonating with what you're saying. What is the next step? Like, how can they reach out to find out more?
Well, yes, we had an open week just last week, and we'll have another one coming up soon after Easter. But no, you can contact the school at any time. If you go onto our website, you can phone or via email, make an appointment, and we call them walkthroughs. So you make an appointment, you get to meet with me. We find out a little bit about you, your family, your background, your children or your child. And then we take you on a tour of the school. And that is not set up. It's brutally honest. We go throughout the school day. We'll go into classes of the age of your child, maybe younger, maybe older, and just get you to experience what a typical day looks like. We'll speak to teachers. We'll speak to some students, particularly some new students, who can then give you their take on the transition that they've had, maybe from their previous school. And then what you do is you get an application pack. You need to fill in an application form, attach any school reports that you have from a previous school, and then we invite you back to meet with the class teacher and the head of the lower or the upper school. And then based on that meeting, very informal, we have to decide if we can meet the child's needs, which more often than not we can. And then you can sign up after that once you've paid a refundable deposit. Mm-hmm. So we do have children that start at various times throughout the year, particularly relocations from overseas. But we had 15 new children started in September time there. So we're on a constant trend of numbers going up. And our capacity would be probably be just over 200. So I would say by 2025, 26, I'd be surprised if we're not at capacity.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Which is great.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm so delighted to have the chance to have this conversation. No sponsorship, no nothing. I love to point people towards alternative paths, and people can make their own decisions. Because, like as you said at the very top of the show, if people don't know, they don't have a choice. And so after listening to this, now people know, and now they actually have the power to make a choice. Roscoe, do you want to hit us with the final question, and then we'll land this plane for good?
What was the question again?
the usual end to all the episodes.
Ah, that one. Okay. So if you can go back in a time machine to an 18-year-old version of yourself, what would you say?
It's a good question. I wasn't expecting that. That was quite some time ago. do you know, it's funny, and actually funny, you mentioned Kyle from Lurgan. I did listen to parts of his podcast, and I think he mentioned about not being particularly academic at school. That would probably be my, I worked very hard in the sports field. I worked very hard in the social side of things, but I didn't work particularly hard in the classroom because I didn't see it as something that I was particularly passionate about. But yet I tell my children that all the time, you must, or you should. So I think if I was going to go back, I would say to myself, look, knuckle down here, you know, particularly coming up to exams. And I did okay on exams. Put a bit more work in, put a bit more effort in, because your academic profile follows you right throughout life, particularly A-levels. Not to say I did okay, but I could have done an awful lot better. So I think I would have knuckled down and maybe worked a wee bit harder.
Yeah.
But still had fun.
Well, it seemed to have worked out pretty well for you in the end. Peter, thank you so much for this time. Really, really appreciate it.
No, thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. And big thank you to Leon Gibson for recommending getting Peter on the show. Really appreciate it. Fab conversation. I hope you guys have a good rest of your day. See you later.